Once again, I bring you greetings from the congregation I serve in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. I also want to say how pleased I am to be here and worshiping with you. I have been challenged and blessed by this series, Darwin and Faith. I hope that you will be challenged and blessed this morning. Let us bow our heads together in prayer. O Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, you who are our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. February 12th, 2009, came and went without much fanfare in Cleveland, Ohio. I venture to say that few people were aware that there was anything noteworthy about that day. Yet February 12th, 2009, marked the 200th anniversary of the birth of two people who have had a profound impact on the world as we know it: Abraham Lincoln and Charles Darwin. How intriguing that these two giants of influence upon world civilization were born, one in the United States and one in England, on the very same day. Abraham Lincoln is arguably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, president that the United States has ever had. His issuing of the Emancipation Proclamation and his steady hand of leadership following that provocative act is a masterful deed, to say the least. His attitude of forgiveness and reconciliation toward the Confederacy did much to set the tone for the healing of the deep-seated wounds that divided regional factions of this country for generations. His ability to transform lofty ideals into practical and effective strategies of leadership is admired to this day. Indeed, Lincoln's philosophy and leadership style have provided a conscious and intentional role model for current President Barack Obama and his administration. Abraham Lincoln is a leader well worth studying, a statesman well worth emulating. On the very same day that Abraham Lincoln was born in Hardin County, Kentucky, across the pond, another person who would influence the world in a profound way was also born, Charles Darwin. Initially studying to become a priest in the Church of England, Darwin developed a deep interest in naturalism. During a visit to South America and the Galapagos Islands, he examined fossil remains of ancient organisms and observed the diversity of life forms in isolated environments. Building on these observations and based on additional work over more than 20 years, Darwin developed the theory of evolution by natural selection. And in 1859, 150 years ago, he published these ideas in his profoundly influential book, The Origin of Species. Darwin proposed that all living species are descended from a small set of common ancestors, perhaps just one ancestor. He held that variations within a species occur randomly, and that the survival or extinction of each organism depends on its ability to adapt to its environment. Darwin's view engendered immediate and intense controversy, especially in religious circles, and the controversy which has continued to this day and shows no signs of abating. Darwin himself was concerned over the effects of his theory on religious belief and took pains in his book, The Origin of Species, to point out a possible harmonious interpretation. And I quote, "I see no good reason," said Darwin, "why the views given in this volume should shock the religious feelings of anyone. A celebrated author and divine has written to me that he has gradually learned to see that it is just as noble a conception of the deity to believe that he created a few original forms capable of self-development into other and needful forms as to believe that he required a fresh act of creation to supply the voids caused by the action of his laws." Darwin concludes his book by saying, "There is grandeur in this view of life. With its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone on cycling on according to fixed law of gravity, from so simply a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved." While Darwin's personal religious beliefs seem ambiguous and varied, it is worthy of note that far from being ostracized by the religious community of his day, Charles Darwin was buried in Westminster Abbey. While no serious biologist today doubts the theory of evolution to explain the marvelous complexity and diversity of life, a recent Gallup poll indicates that only 1/3 of Americans believe that the theory of evolution is well supported, with the remainder being equally divided between those who agree that it has not been well supported and those claiming that they just don't know enough about evolution to affirm or reject it. These statistics have remained essentially unchanged over the past 20 years. The theory of evolution rests on two basic ideas: that all of life is related and that species change over time. First of all, scientists insist that all of life is related. If you hug a tree, you are really hugging a relative, a very distant relative, but a relative nonetheless. From the outset, one of the objections to the idea that we are all related is the idea that human beings are descended from apes and monkeys. Thomas Huxley, a contemporary of Darwin's, is reported to have said that he was not ashamed to have a monkey for an ancestor, only ashamed to be related to anyone who obscured the truth. Scientists reassure us that we are not descended from apes and monkeys the way those species are now. It's just that we share common ancestors. How do we know this? The same way we know whether people are related to one another. Everybody these days knows, thanks to courtroom television, that DNA can be used to determine paternity. Because children share the DNA of their parents, we can tell whether people are related by seeing if their DNA is the same. This principle works across all living things. While the study of genes and the DNA which comprises them has been going on for years, the Human Genome Project, completed in 2003, revealed more about the interrelatedness of life than humanity had previously known. It was discovered, for example, that while there are 3.1 billion letters of the DNA code arranged across 24 chromosomes comprising the human genome, there are only about 20 to 25,000 protein-coding genes. That was especially shocking in light of the fact that the gene count for other simpler organisms, such as worms, flies, and simple plants, seemed to be in about the same range as that for humans, approximately 20,000 protein-coding genes. Francis Collins, who headed the Human Genome Project until last August, comments, "Many of us were shocked to discover that God writes such short stories about humankind." Another striking, and I believe theologically profound finding coming from the Human Genome Project is that at the DNA level, all of the different members of our human species are 99.9% identical. And that similarity applies regardless of which two individuals around the world you wish to compare. At this time, please take a look at the person sitting next to you. Go ahead, it won't hurt to turn and look in church. Look at the person sitting next to you on the right. Look at the person sitting next to you on the left. 99.9% of your DNA is exactly the same. Thus, by DNA analysis, we are truly members of one family. The second fact of evolutionary biology is that species change. This was what Darwin observed on the Galapagos Islands and what scientists and non-scientists observe all the time. The size, shape, and color of plants and animals change through time and space, demonstrating the difference between living things and non-living things. A chemical species, such as water, never changes. Water is always colorless. It always freezes, boils at the same temperature. There never was a time or a place where pure water was red or green or blue, for example, but the species of living things change over time. In her recent book, Evolution and the Christian Faith, Joan Roughgarden, professor of biological sciences and geophysics at Stanford University, says, "The single tree of life and species change discoveries are bottom line, take-home facts. I believe that these two facts must be taught in any science curriculum today. Not teaching these, she states, will cripple the minds of children, as though asking them to find a place in modern society after being raised with wolves. Far from being at odds with religion in general and the Christian faith in particular, I find that the two major premises of evolutionary biology are quite compatible with orthodox thinking. First of all of life is related. The most accepted theory of the creation of the world among scientists at the current time is the Big Bang theory, which states that at a single moment, approximately 14 billion years ago, the universe began. Of course, the Big Bang theory begs the question of what came before that, and who or what was responsible for the forces coming together that created the universe in the first place. Again, Francis Collins writes, "The Big Bang theory cries out for a divine explanation. It forces the conclusion that nature had a defined beginning. I cannot see," he writes, "how nature could have created itself. Only a supernatural force that is outside of space and time could have done that. For the Judeo-Christian tradition, the opening words of Genesis are entirely compatible with the Big Bang. Genesis 1:1 tells us that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Theology has long held that the universe was created by God out of nothingness, created ex nihilo. Astronaut Robert Jastrow, in his book, God and the Astronomer, states, "At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock," and I love this sentence, "he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." The creation poem set in the Garden of Eden that we are hearing so beautifully put to music this morning describes God creating all the species of plants and animals. Does Genesis 1 contradict evolution's tree of life? No, Genesis does not specify one way or the other about whether the plants and animals God placed on the earth are related one to the other. They are, however, all designed and made by the same Creator. God does not tell us how. Genesis does not tell us how God created. It only tells us why. God created humanity in God's image for fellowship with God. All of life is related. A fact which has now been proven by science, a fact which has broad implications as communication increases and the world continues to shrink before our very eyes. All of life is related as we realize that we are doing irreparable damage to the land, the water, and the species of plants and animal life that God has taken millions of years to create. All of life is related, we need to remember, as we seek solutions to problems that threaten to destroy the very breath of life that God breathed into our nostrils on the dawn of creation. And that brings me to the second fact of evolutionary biology that is also quite compatible with the Christian gospel, that species change over time. Scientists have observed mutation occurring in plants and insects and other species through laboratory experimentation and the examination of fossils. Change is vital to the survival of living things. Change is also fundamental to our belief system. Change is a cornerstone of the Christian gospel. I have chosen Jesus' discussion with Nicodemus to illustrate my point. Nicodemus was intrigued by the teaching of Jesus and the way of life he demonstrated. Nicodemus came to Jesus by night, for he didn't want to admit to the other intellectuals of his day that his education and his profession had not brought him the happiness and satisfaction for which he yearned. Nicodemus sensed that there must be something in life that he was missing. Jesus told Nicodemus that he needed to be born again, that he needed to accept God's lordship of all things and start looking at life through fresh, new eyes. The most important part of life, according to this Jewish teacher, was not what we can get, but what we can give. We can begin living a new life, not someday when we die, but here and now, this very day. We don't know whether Nicodemus came to faith immediately or whether the process took some time. But we do know that after Jesus was crucified, Nicodemus came with Joseph of Arimathea to claim and to care for the body of Jesus. Nicodemus, who formerly had been afraid to be seen with Jesus for fear of what people would think, was now willing to risk his reputation and his very life in order to care for the body of his crucified Lord. A profound change had taken place in his life. Whether or not the account in Acts is totally accurate, we know that another man was changed dramatically as Saul, the persecutor of Christians, became Paul the Apostle, the greatest missionary the Christian church has ever known. Again, a change of heart and life is a fundamental result of the gospel message. Species can change. It was the founder of the Methodist movement, John Wesley, who urged his followers not to be satisfied with where they currently were in their spiritual lives, but to go on to perfection. Citing Matthew 5:48, "Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect," John Wesley urged a continual striving, a continual process of change and growth, causing the Christian believer to evolve, if you will, toward the person that God intends us to be. For some, the change is profound and dramatic. The Apostle Paul is a profound and a prime example. For others, the change is more subtle and gradual. But for all living things, change is essential, not only for our growth, but for our survival in God's world. It is true in the physical realm, my friends. I submit to you this morning that it is also true in the realm of the Spirit. Some people just have the gift of storytelling. When Professor Harold Beck lectured on the origins of the Hebrew Bible, he made the story so real in my seminary class that I wanted to sneak a peek to the corner of the room to which he was gesturing. I wanted to catch a glimpse of the Bedouin shepherds and the campfire they had built to take the chill off the night air. He made the story just that realistic, and I found later that others in the class experienced the same feeling. Dr. Beck said when he went to speak at local churches, which was frequently, he wanted to go up to the altar and take the Bible and rip off the back cover to demonstrate the fact that God did not stop speaking in the second century AD, nor have the Acts of the Apostles ceased. The Bible is still being written today, he would proclaim in a thundering voice. Species can change. Species do change. In his book, The Language of God, Francis Collins tells about being asked to head the Human Genome Project. At the time, he was quite happy at the University of Michigan, and he commented that he never imagined himself a federal employee. "I initially indicated no interest," he wrote, "but the decision haunted me. There was only one Human Genome Project. This was going to be done only once in human history. If it succeeded, the consequences for medicine would be unprecedented." As a believer in God, was this one of the moments, he asked himself, when I was somehow being called to take on a larger role in a project that would have profound consequences for our understanding of ourselves? "I have always been suspicious," he writes, "of those who claim to perceive God's will in moments such as this. But the potential consequences for humankind's relationship with the Creator could hardly be ignored. Visiting my daughter in North Carolina in November of 1992, I spent a long afternoon praying in a little chapel, seeking guidance about this decision. I did not hear God speak. In fact, I have never had that experience. But during those hours, a peace settled over me, and a few days later, I accepted the offer." Collins' work has demonstrated and confirmed the theory of Charles Darwin that all of life is related and that species change. As Harold Beck so dramatically proclaimed to our seminary class, the Bible is still being written today. God is still speaking. God is still creating. The Bible is still being written. My friends, I ask you this morning, what will your chapter say? How will you demonstrate your awareness to your relationship to all of creation? How will you respond to God's call to continue to evolve and to let God create in you the person that God desires you to be? I believe that as long as we are living, we are always evolving. May we always seek to grow in the image and the likeness of God.